Welcome to Ekhatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're embarking on a journey into, well, a truly monumental work, Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain, or Der Zauberberg in the original German.
A giant of a book.
Absolutely. And Mann himself, you know, Nobel Prize winner in 1929, just a towering figure in 20th century German literature. He was famous for dissecting European culture, bourgeois society, the human condition itself.
And his own life fed into this book quite directly, didn't it? Those visits to his wife in Swiss sanatoriums.
Exactly. That experience deeply shaped The Magic Mountain, which he published in 1924. And you have to think about the timing. Post-World War I, the fragile Weimar Republic in Germany. Europe was really wrestling with itself, caught between progress and tradition.
A real turning point.
Right. So our goal today is to kind of cut through the density of this very rich novel, give you the core insights, and show you why it's still such a cornerstone of world literature.
And it kicks off with such an intriguing premise, doesn't it? You've got this young man, seems perfectly ordinary.
Franz Castorp.
Franz Castorp, yes. He plans this very short visit, just 3 weeks, to a Swiss sanatorium to see his sick cousin. But what actually happens is this seven-year odyssey, an incredible journey of intellectual and, well, spiritual transformation.
All while stuck on this mountain.
Exactly. In a world seemingly suspended in time, way above the everyday flatland. It's a Bildungsroman, you know, a novel of education. But it completely flips the script on that genre.
How so?
Well, instead of the usual optimistic journey towards, like, a successful career or something, Hans's education plunges him into this much deeper, more ambiguous understanding of life. Sickness, death, time itself.
That premise just immediately pulls you in. A simple visit turning into this profound exploration of existence. So, okay, let's set the scene a bit more. Who is Hans Castorp, really? And what's the Berghof like?
Well, Hans is introduced as this respectable, maybe even slightly unremarkable, young engineer from Hamburg. He travels up to the international sanatorium Berghof, high in the Swiss Alps, to visit his cousin, Joachim Ziemsen, who's a patient there.
And his plan is clear.
Very clear. 3 weeks max, then back to the practical, orderly life, back to the flatland and his engineering career. But the Berghof, I mean, from the moment he arrives, it's just different.
A world apart.
Totally. Mann paints it as this complete microcosm of pre-war European society.
Mm-hmm.
A magic mountain, right? Where normal time just seems to dissolve. The daily routines, the strict rest cure, 5 meals a day, always taking your temperature. It creates this life that's somehow both rigid and utterly timeless.
And this is where Mann starts to subtly shift things. It's not just a hospital. You called it a microcosm, but it's also like a pedagogical space, you know, a sealed world with its own rules for time, morality, how you even see reality.
Mm-hmm.
And Hans gets sucked in so easily. A minor cold. Suddenly there's a diagnosis, this mice spot on his lung. And just like that, he's absorbed into this world.
His 3 weeks turn into... Well, 7 years.
Exactly. And what's fascinating, I think, is that his journey isn't really about getting physically better. It's about this intellectual and spiritual re-education, maybe even a kind of intellectual sickness.
Right.
Which forces us and Hans to ask, what does it actually mean to be well? Not just physically, but intellectually, spiritually. It really challenges our modern ideas about health and purpose. So, as Hans settles in, he becomes our lens, our sort of guide through this strange place. He's presented as this everyman conventional background, but he has this latent curiosity, maybe even a morbid fascination.
Mm-hmm. Definitely a morbid streak.
Which makes him really receptive to being transformed. He doesn't actively seek out ideas so much as he passively absorbs them, which makes him the perfect battleground almost for the competing forces on the mountain.
Absolutely. And the first major force he encounters is Ludovico Settembrini. He's this Italian humanist, a writer, a passionate rationalist.
A voice of reason.
Very much so. Eloquent, witty, tireless champion of enlightenment ideals, reason, progress, democracy. Settembrini sees it as his mission to save Hans from what he considers the mountain's morbid, unhealthy atmosphere. He's always urging him back to the life down below.
He becomes Hans's first real intellectual mentor, embodying that 19th century humanistic spirit. Its strengths, but maybe its limitations too. Mann subtly questions if pure reason is enough, especially with WWI looming, though they don't know it yet.
Right, and then almost immediately we meet Leo Nafta, Settembrini's total ideological opposite, his arch nemesis.
Tell us about Nafta.
He's a brilliant Jesuit scholar, Jewish background, physically small but incredibly sharp. NAFTA represents this complex, dangerous mix, religious mysticism, revolutionary politics, philosophical extremism. If Settembrini is reason, NAFTA is the seductive power of unreason, perhaps.
His philosophy is genuinely radical, isn't it? Advocating for violent change, faith over reason, even terror. He fuses medieval thinking with modern revolutionary ideas in this startling way. And the debates between them, these ceaseless, dazzling intellectual duels, are really the heart of the novel's ideas. They argue about everything: humanism versus mysticism, liberalism versus authoritarianism.
It perfectly mirrors the tensions simmering in Europe at the time.
And Hans is just sort of caught in the middle, listening, absorbing it all, often bewildered.
Absolutely. And amidst all this intellectual ferment, there's Clavia Chochat, this beautiful, quite enigmatic Russian patient.
With the Kyrgyz eyes.
Yes, that detail, suggesting something exotic, non-European. And she has this feline grace and that habit of slamming doors.
Oh, right, the door slam.
She becomes the focus of Hans's obsessive transformative love. It's this silent, all-consuming passion.
Clavia is more than just a love interest, though. Symbolically, she represents this mysterious feminine allure, maybe an Eastern European sensuality that challenges Hans's Northern European rationality.
She awakens something different in him.
Definitely his erotic side. But his love for her feels intertwined with his illness, with the whole atmosphere of the sanatorium. It's like a symptom itself, a kind of fever.
That's a great way to put it. And then there's Hans's cousin, Joachim Simpson. He's the foil, really.
A sensible one.
The sensible, disciplined young military officer. All he wants is to get well and get back to his duty in the flatland. He represents purpose, tradition.
Joachim's story is quite poignant, though. He represents duty, honor, all those traditional values. But his arc, leaving, relapsing, eventually dying back on the mountain, it's a grim warning, isn't it?
It really is a warning about the mountain's power.
And a real contrast to Hans's passivity. Joachim tries to fight it with willpower, and, well, it doesn't end well.
No, it doesn't. And then, much later in the novel, Mynheer Pieperkorn arrives, a wealthy Dutch coffee planter, Clavdia's companion at that point. He's this huge Dionysian figure.
Dionysian. Meaning?
Meaning raw, primal, ecstatic energy, life force. He communicates more through grand gestures and feelings than actual words.
Pieperkorn is just this overwhelming presence. He represents life itself, maybe. Inarticulate, but incredibly powerful. His arrival makes Settembrini and NAFTA's intellectual debates seem suddenly pale.
Almost irrelevant, yeah.
And his end is significant, too. That dramatic, meticulously planned suicide. It feels like a final statement on pure, unthinking existence, its triumph and its tragedy. So, with all these characters influencing Hans, what actually happens over these 7 years? The narrative isn't really driven by big plot events in the usual sense.
Not at all. It's all about Hans's internal shifts, his changing perception of time, and man plays with the pacing deliberately. Weeks can take pages early on, then years fly by later. It mirrors Hans's own subjective experience.
So walk us through his journey.
Well, those initial weeks are about immersion, getting used to the strange rhythms, the growing fascination, and then that moist spot diagnosis that makes his stay indefinite. He quickly becomes the focus of that ideological battle between Settembrini and NAFTA, soaking up their arguments.
While pining for Clavidia.
Exactly. All while nursing this silent passion, which culminates in that Walpurgis Night scene. The carnival rules suspended. Hans, feverish, confesses his love to Clavdia, crucially, in French.
A symbolic break from his background.
Right, and he borrows her pencil. That tiny act becomes loaded with significance, almost fetishistic.
But then she leaves.
Leaves the very next day. And Hans sinks into this period of, well, morbid contemplation. He starts studying biology, botany, music, losing touch with the flatland entirely. Years start to blur.
And then comes the snow chapter.
Ah, yes. Pivotal. Hans goes skiing alone, gets caught in a blizzard, totally lost, falls into this hypothermic sleep, and he has this incredibly powerful dream.
Two parts to it, right?
Yes. First, this beautiful, idyllic, classical scene, sunny landscape, noble people, humanistic harmony. But then suddenly he sees inside a temple, and it's horrific. Witches tearing apart a child.
It's the philosophical core, isn't it? That dream epiphany. When he wakes up, he has this moment of clarity.
The key insight.
For the sake of goodness and love, man shall let death have no sovereignty over his thoughts. It's this profound call for humanistic balance. Acknowledge the darkness, the irrational, but don't surrender to it. Choose life.
A beautiful, powerful thought.
But the tragedy is, He forgets it. Almost as soon as he's back in the comfort, the routine of the sanatorium, that insight just slips away. He goes back to his kind of intellectual days.
It's heartbreaking, really. So the later years, Clavdia returns, but with Peepercorn, who dominates everything with his sheer vitality. After Peepercorn's dramatic suicide, the sanatorium falls into what man calls the great stupor. Petty arguments, seances.
Spiritualism, yeah. A sign of decay.
Definitely. And Nasta, after one last furious argument with the Settembrini, he ends up shooting himself in this bizarrely failed duel, the self-destruction of extremism.
And then the outside world finally breaks in.
The Thunderbolt. Shattering news from the Flatland. Archduke Franz Ferdinand assassinated. World War I breaks out. The dream is over. The bubble bursts.
That hermetically sealed world is shattered. The international community there instantly fractures along national lines. And Hans, after 7 years,
abruptly discharged, sent down from the mountain. The final image is him, now just an anonymous soldier, stumbling across a muddy, bloody battlefield, singing to himself.
His fate completely uncertain, a really stark, powerful ending to that long, strange education. Okay, so the Magic Mountain is clearly a masterclass in exploring big themes. Let's try and distill some of the core takeaways. What do we really learn? First, maybe time and temporality.
Oh, absolutely. Man shows how subjective time is. On the mountain, it stretches, it compresses.
Yeah.
It's completely different from clock time down below. Our environment really shapes our perception of existence.
Makes you wonder how our own modern lives, you know, distort our sense of time. Then there's sickness and health. Man just completely blurs those lines.
He really does. Sickness isn't just bad. It can be an escape, a path to deeper insight. But it's also a trap, leading to passivity. He kind of suggests this stupidly healthy Flatlanders might be missing something important.
And that connects to the dialectic of life and death. Death is so present at the Berghof, it forces everyone to confront existence. Hans's whole education, really, seems to be about understanding life by studying death up close.
Can you truly appreciate life without thinking about its end? That seemed to be the question.
Then the big one. Reason versus irrationality. Settembrini versus NAFTA. It's the crisis of pre-WWI Europe played out in miniature, right?
Yeah.
Humanism versus fanaticism. Democracy versus totalitarianism.
And Hans is caught right in the middle. It shows how a society lost in abstract debates can just miss the approaching catastrophe.
And love as education and disease. Hans's passion for Clavdia is like a fever tied up with illness.
Man connects the body, love, and death. He says they're carnal, both love and death, and this is their terror and their great magic. It teaches about desire, but also its destructive side.
Finally, the whole Berghof as an allegory of pre-war Europe, an insulated, self-absorbed society, brilliant debates, but ultimately sterile, blind to the disaster coming. It's a chilling warning about detachment.
It really is. And man brings it all alive with this incredibly controlled, often ironic prose. That rich vocabulary just elevates everything, the sanatorium.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the gilded cage, too comfortable debating philosophy to notice the storm outside.
So the question this leaves us with, maybe, is how does this challenge us today? Our assumptions about health, productivity, the way time should pass, it really makes you think about what we value and what we might be ignoring in our own flatlands.
Mm-hmm.
Man's craft itself is just astounding. Let's touch on that. His narrative perspective, third person, omniscient, but with this witty philosophical narrator who keeps interrupting.
Almost like another character commenting on time and storytelling. It creates this intellectual distance, invites you into the game.
Mm-hmm. And the symbolism is everywhere, isn't it? So consistently worked out. The mountain versus the flatland sickness, contemplation versus health, action.
Fever and temperature, not just illness, but heightened states. Emotional or spiritual.
The x-ray.
Mm.
Seeing the skeleton inside, that morbid knowledge, death under the surface of life.
And Clavius Kensel, that small object, becomes such a potent symbol of desire, almost fetishistic.
Man also uses leitmotif brilliantly, that Wagnerian technique. Recurring phrases, images.
Like Clavius door slamming, or Jochen's military stiffness, or Settembrini calling Hans engineer of life.
Exactly. It weaves this dense web, gives it that symphonic quality. Ideas and images echo and deepen over the hundreds of pages.
It makes it feel so layered, building like music.
And underlying it all is irony, that sophisticated, sometimes gentle, sometimes sharp irony, mocking Hans's grand education that leads where? To a battlefield.
Yeah, and the contrast between the high-flown debates and the petty realities of sanatorium life. It's funny, but also deeply sad when you think about what's coming.
These devices just work together seamlessly, creating something incredibly profound. So reflecting on all this, what really stands out about the Magic Mountain is just its sheer scope, its ambition, a true symphonic novel of ideas. It tackles these huge human concerns in a way that still resonates.
It absolutely does. It leaves you with these big, unsettling questions, doesn't it? About contemplation versus action, about needing to understand death to understand life. That's why it still feels so relevant, forcing us to examine our own choices.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.